Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 28. It's June 8th, 2020. As I became increasingly interested in the role of formal property systems in economic development, I made numerous trips to advanced nations to find out how their property rights experts would go about integrating a nation's extra-legal assets into one legal property system. After 13 years, thousands of miles, and a little more gray hair, I had visited just about every property-related organization in the advanced world, from my friends in Her Majesty's Land Registry and the Alaska Land Authority to the Japanese Tokibo. No one had an answer. All the experts I queried, all the professionals associated with the myriad property-related institutions and agencies I visited, admitted they had never thought about the question. People who operate property systems in advanced nations have fundamentally different concerns. They are largely preoccupied with matters relating to property rights. My primary concern, however, was not property rights per se, but meta rights, access or rights to property rights. Although we had many subjects of mutual interest, such as how to re-engineer a record-keeping organization so as to integrate information gathered in the field into one database, or how to develop procedures to digitize boundaries on base maps, the property experts could not tell me how to bring people who hold their assets by extra-legal arrangements into the legal property system. How do you give people rights to legal property rights? It was obvious from what little Western history I had read that at some point in their past, all Western nations had made the transition from dispersed, informal arrangements to an integrated legal property system. So why didn't I just go there, into the history of the West, to see how their property systems had evolved? My hosts agreed wholeheartedly, and the history buffs at Her Majesty's Land Registry and the German Association of Licensed Surveyors pointed me to their favorite books. My reading, thousands of pages later, led me to the fundamental conclusion that the transition to integrated legal property systems had little to do with technology, although technology plays a very important supporting role, as we shall see in Chapter 6. The crucial change had to do with adapting the law to the social and economic needs of the majority of the population. Gradually, Western nations became able to acknowledge that social contracts born outside the official law were a legitimate source of law and to find ways of absorbing those contracts. Law was thus made to serve popular capital formation and economic growth. This is what gives the present property institutions of the West their vitality. Moreover, this property revolution was always a political victory. In every country, it was a result of a few enlightened men deciding that official law made no sense if a sizable part of the population lived outside of it. The various histories of property in Western Europe, Japan, and the United States all have something useful to say about the present concerns of developing and former communist countries. In each country, apparent lawlessness was not really about crime, but a collision between rulemaking at the grassroots level and rulemaking at the top. The revolution in each case involved the gradual merging of both systems. However, detailed histories of all these countries would be too much for this book. I've decided, therefore, to focus on the United States because more than 150 years ago, it too was a third world country. The governments and judiciary of the young states, not yet so legally united, were trying to cope with the law and disorder of migrants, squatters, gold diggers, armed gangs, illegal entrepreneurs, and the rest of the colorful characters who made the settling of this American West so wild and, if only in hindsight, so romantic. To a third worlder like me, this picture of the gringo past is astonishingly familiar. Although my colleagues and I have trouble relating to 11,000 on the Dow Jones, we feel quite at home among the squatters at Thomas Jefferson's Virginia or the log cabin settlements of Daniel Boone's Kentucky. Like third world authorities today, American governments tried to stem the exponential increase of squatters and extra-legal arrangements. But unlike third world authorities, they eventually conceded that, in the words of one U.S. congressman, the land system is virtually broken down, and instead of legislating for them, we are to legislate after them in full pursuit to the Rocky Mountains or the Pacific Ocean. What U.S. politicians eventually learned, as Frank Philbrick put it, was that the forces that changed the law in other than trivial ways lie outside it. Even the celebrated Homestead Act of 1862, which entitled settlers to 160 acres of free land simply for agreeing to live on it and develop it, was less an act of official generosity than the recognition of a fait accompli. Americans had been settling and improving the land extra-legally for decades. Their politicians gradually modified the law to integrate this reality into the official legal system and won some political points in the bargain. Having thus changed their laws to accommodate existing extra-legal arrangements, U.S. officials left the assets of the American settlers and miners primed to be converted into capital. As in the United States in the 19th century, the challenge of capitalizing the poor in the Third World and former communist countries is at the bottom a political challenge that has to be reformed with legal tools. In describing the evolution of property in the United States, as I will do in this chapter, I do not presume to rewrite the history of America. Like my legendary namesake, I am simply exploring it. In the process, as you will see, I found many examples that reminded me of developing and former communist countries today. Massive migrations, explosions of extra-legal activity, political unrest, and general discontent with an antiquated legal system that refused to acknowledge that its doctrines and formulas had little relevance to the real world. I also found how U.S. law gradually integrated extra-legal arrangements to bring about a peaceful order, thereby confirming Justice Holmes' opinion that it is experience that gives life to the law, demonstrating, as we shall see in the next chapter, that the law must be compatible with how people actually arrange their lives. The law stays alive. The way the law stays alive is by keeping in touch with social contracts, pieced together among real people on the ground. This is, we have returned to the mystery of capital, why capitalism triumphs in the West and fails everywhere else, written by Peruvian economist Hernando de Soto, reading from chapter 5, which is the missing lessons of U.S. history. And it's pretty fascinating. When he uses the term extra-legal, I believe what he's talking about is, for example, somewhere in here they go and he has a bunch of graduate students and other research help, and they go to open a dry cleaner in the United States, and it takes several months, and there's these, you know, handful of steps you have to do to be an official dry cleaner now. And he compares it to a Latin American country, I forget which, and it's 150 steps. It takes over a year. Basically, there's bribery at every step. And so it's legal to operate a dry cleaner. But in other parts of the world, many of them are not officially sanctioned. They're not legal in that they haven't walked through this, quote, legal process to get all the paperwork. So they can't go to a bank and borrow, like, say, you might if you had a dry cleaner in the United States. It's a much easier process to take your assets and, in DeSoto's sort of language and framework, turn it into capital. One of the striking things here is talking about how it's the social contracts that were then eventually subsumed in into the legal system. What he clearly sees a legal economy, then there's an illegal economy, things you just are not allowed to do. They're illegal. But in between, there are these, there's a huge global amount of activity, staggeringly large, that is otherwise legal activity, but isn't represented in the legal system. A striking thing here too is his mention of how, and he delves into the history. Before even, you know, in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s in America, and that the legal system had to bow to the popular will, of course. And he's focused, I think very appropriately, as a Peruvian economist, trying to solve global problems and thinking about what's going to happen to the world with the fall of the Berlin Wall, et cetera. And his home sort of region of Latin America, thinking about what lessons need to be learned about the United States and how the United States allowed capital formation to flourish. Of course, looking back now, just within the lens focused only on the United States, one can also see how social contracts, the will of the popular will of the majority, and such things, that when that transition occurred, and even, you know, much later into the 1900s, there's all these layers that are rigging the game, to a great extent, and harming capital formation from various communities. That's clear. I think this week I will read from the infamous Austin City Plan of 1928. It's online. I went and found it. And it is as bad as you've heard. It's a hideous legal document from the city. And it strikes right at the heart here of what DeSoto is talking about. And it shows how it isn't merely about property rights. I like this idea of meta rights. He said that his primary concern, however, was not property rights per se, but meta rights, access or rights to property rights. And it is clear that up until, I don't know, 5 minutes ago, yet very recently in time, that those meta rights were not in a market economy of sufficient breadth. There were people locked out. Lots of people locked out without access to those meta rights. Therefore, they couldn't get property rights. They had property rights. They were able to participate in the property rights, but only in certain pockets, only with certain boundaries. And that's a hammer of economic harm to those people. It's a hammer of economic harm to all of us, because the goal here is to have it where everyone can participate freely, and that risk-taking and entrepreneurship and trade flourish. We all gain when this happens. DeSoto, too, reminds me, with the regulars, one of the things we do, we haven't done it yet this year because of the lockdowns, the regulars' day off. We take a day, take the day off, like Ferris and Cameron and Sloan in the movie, and we go all over the place. One year, we went to the land office, the general land office in Texas. Is it something like 17th and Congress? It's an office, state office building right by the Capitol. It's not a museum, but they have museum-quality artifacts. It's intense. They have 43,000 maps in a map vault. They have 2.3 million documents. I believe the land office is the oldest Texas bureaucratic agency because it came into being immediately. The Texas Land Office honored land grants given by the government of Mexico, honored land grants given by the government of Spain, and they have their records. There's a period of time, of course, when you're not looking at digital databases, you're talking paper records. The way it worked, an interesting factor was, part of the reason it was formed was they owed soldiers land. The country of Texas, when fighting its war of independence against Mexico, didn't have much in the way of money, couldn't compensate its soldiers by paying them. So it offered land, had lots of land. And I believe if you fought for 6 months, now I'm going to get the numbers wrong, I believe it was 600 acres. If you fought longer than 6 months, it doubled. If you died, whatever you were to be awarded doubled again. And the whole conflict lasted less than a year. So there were some in the 6 month bucket, some in the between more than 6 months, less than 12 months bucket. And if you survived the war and you wanted to go get your acreage, you had to go hire a surveyor and I suppose go out on horses and get your drawings on a map, bring them back to the state. There were rules, of course. You couldn't take your acreage all along a river. There were rules about how all of that worked. But you could literally just go anywhere, pick your land, come back, have it officially blessed, and now it's yours. And if you were a survivor of someone who perished in the war, you had to bring documentary evidence that your ancestor did serve, was in fact your ancestor, you know, your uncle or great uncle or whatever. You had to prove these things, and then you were able to take that land. Interestingly about all of that part of the story is that Texas is only a country for like 9 years, 1836 to 1845. It has massive debts as a country. Probably, though I'm no expert on this, but probably borrowed to fight the war and deal with being a new country. So, and most of that money was owed to the United States government and United States banks. And Texas, when becoming a state, offers to the United States federal government, we will convert all Texas land to United States federal land under federal jurisdiction if you will cancel the debt. And the United States government, in its wisdom, declined that offer, preferring instead to be paid the $10 million. So I believe a giant issue in most of the early gubernatorial elections was what taxes would be raised. How the heck are we going to pay back all of this money? Texas does pay back the debt. And of course, later oil is discovered in the state. And I will post in the show notes, which I suppose will be at regular.fm/28, links to a couple of maps that of the United States that show what percentage of each state is federally controlled. And in Texas, it's something like 1.8% of the state is federally controlled. In Nevada, it's over 80% of Nevada is federally controlled. Those stretches of land were territories, purchases, other things, and came through a different kind of federal system. Texas was a nation that was annexed. Texas also, reportedly, from our visit at the land office, it is considered Texas state property 3 miles from the coastline of Texas. Every other state, it's 1 mile. Turns out a fair bit of oil was also discovered between 1 mile and 3 miles of the coast. And more still could be discovered there. All of that money has flowed into the state coffers. None of that money is going into federal coffers. All of that money has powered the formation of the University of Texas system and the Texas A&M system. Another interesting little bit from back then, there is a group of professionals who manage the endowments of A&M system, UT system. Back then, I don't know when exactly back then is, to be honest, late 1800s. With all that state land, there were just maintenance fees mainly. Oil has not been discovered yet. No, there's no petroleum industry. That doesn't exist. And so the UT system is about twice the size then of the A&M system. They were paying 50-50 for the maintenance fees and such. It was an expense line on their financial statements. And the A&M system said, hey, by the way, you're twice our size. Why don't you pay for twice the maintenance here? It's not really fair. And the UT system said, okay, that's fine. But if any value ever comes out of this land, we get twice and your share. We get 2/3, you get 1/3. And that gets papered too. So if you look today, again, I'm probably going to miss the numbers. I'll look them up and put them in the show notes. But the endowment of UT is something like $26 billion, and A&M is like something like $13 billion. And it's also because of that factor. So it is amazing to think about how much capital flows are tributary to these decisions. The United States asking for $10 million cash and not all of that land. And then on a smaller scale later, A&M and UT having an internal discussion around the maintenance fees and management and stewardship of those state lands. Fascinating stuff. The DeSoto stuff is also really fascinating because with folks like Peter Zeihan talking about geography and moving up from that layer into culture, politics, and such. De Soto is concerned primarily with this representational layer of capital, capital formation on top of assets, this ethereal, incorporeal system, which is therefore very hard to see. It's hard enough to see the impact of the rivers and arable land and all of this that we enjoy. It's even trickier to see these kinds of representational systems. And one factor among a few, you know, countless factors that are at play right now is a recognition and reckoning around addressing the fact that some of these representational tools were weaponized against certain pockets of our population and people. And what do we do about that? It's fascinating stuff. Maybe tomorrow I'll read the city plan from 1928. It's a stunner. Y'all have a good one. Thanks.